Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, white, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics podcast. If you are new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at talkingjoe.co.uk. Now, today we will be talking to Devil's Due editor, well, at the time, Mike O'Sullivan. He was editor for much of the second half of the Devil's Due era of G.I. Joe, joining as associate editor from around about issue 37. He wrote several things for the run, including Hunt for Cobra Commander, a backup story, and most of the G.I. Joe Special Missions issues, Scarlet Declassified and G.I. Joe America's Elite 19-20. So he was definitely the man in the room where it all happened at the time. But I will not be talking to him alone. I will be joined, as always, by my co-presenter. It's Tim Finn. Tim.
Hello, Mark. And hello, listeners and viewers. And Mark, you left out some of the superlatives. Longest running G.I. Joe Comics podcast. Best G.I. Joe Comics podcast. At least that's what my mother tells me. Enough of that. Let's introduce our guest.
Here we go. It's the man of the moment that we've all come to see. It's Mike O'Sullivan. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
It's our pleasure and privilege. And talking to you actually comes hot on the heels of our last Devil's Due episode, where we're doing our deep dive look back at the era where we looked at the two issues of America's Elite that you wrote, which Tim is holding up for us, 19 and 20.
Oh, I hope you were kind.
I am never kind.
Okay. Good to know.
When I review comics. Mike, from where are you recording in on this call?
I live in Washington, D.C., in the States, Washington, D.C.
I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, which is just a few miles outside of D.C.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. I love this city.
How often do you go to one of D.C.'s amazing, federally funded, free museums?
All the time during the off season. Never during spring, summer, forget it.
When you say off season, are you talking about a sporting team?
I'm talking about the tourists.
Oh.
Yep.
Okay.
You can go and visit Amazing Fantasy issue 15 in the Library of Congress or something like that. Am I remembering correctly?
They actually have a huge comic book collection there at the Library of Congress. You have to go through an application process to be able to see them, but they are there, and I'm excited. I know that I've got a couple of things that I worked on in there, so kind of fun. The first thing that I ever had that was entered in there was the Sigma Six hardback issues.
Oh wow!
When I worked on that miniseries, we did a hardback edition of the six issues, and those were the first things that I know of that were put in there. So. Kind of proud of that.
Very good.
I guess I brought the excitement down by mentioning Sigma Six, but
no, boy, I can just see the cogs in Tim's brain going, Right. What to ask about that?
It's two things. One, my mom worked for the Senate and would just be able to go to the Library of Congress whenever she wanted and check out things. And two, I hadn't realized that there was a hardcover of the Sigma Six issues. And those were the gears that were turning. So sort of imagining, you know, listings I've seen on the internet and hearing it from the person who was in charge, it must be true. But I was thinking, was there really a hardcover? Should I Google this? No, Mike O'Sullivan is telling me.
Yeah, I've got a copy of each of the six hardcovers and I love them. I mean, I have to admit, I loved my time on Joe. Like you wouldn't even believe. I mean, G.I. Joe number one was the first comic book that I personally bought myself. I bought it off the stands. So when it came out. So getting to work on Joe was amazing, but the most fun I ever had on a Joe project was the Sigma Six series. Because it was, I wasn't so worried about continuity and I wasn't so worried about story matching what came before and what was coming up. You know, they were self-contained issues and they were just fun. It was just a lot of fun to work on those. So even though I know that the toy line wasn't as accepted as Hasbro wishes it was, those books hold a kind of a little warm spot in my heart.
I feel like since we're in Sigma Six, we should stay on Sigma Six, despite that tease of buying Real American Hero number one. So I'm going to follow this up with a couple Sigma Six questions. Mark loves it when I go out of order.
I've got my issues here. Actually, I pulled them. I've got my soft copies, my floppy copies here.
What do you remember of the tenor coming from Hasbro about this relaunch of G.I. Joe in Sigma Six, because a lot of development had been done on what was going to be the follow-up to Spy Troops and Valor versus Venom, which was to be called Robot Rebellion. Mm. And some of that development in toys and in animation was sort of funneled or turned into what became Sigma Six. So what do you remember of sort of people in the office at Devil's Due talking about the beginning of Sigma Six?
There was always a certain amount of anxiety when Hasbro got involved. Where do I start? When working on any of Hasbro's properties, for me, it was G.I. Joe was my main one. Dungeons and Dragons, I worked on them also on those projects. You had to go through a formal submission project or process for every step of every book. So we were submitting things and then they would come back with these long lists and it could take up to 10 days to get the response back. And then we'd come back with long lists of what they wanted changed, what they didn't want, what they did want, et cetera, et cetera. So they were always involved, but when they kind of got a heavy hand is when we got nervous. We knew with Sigma Six that it was going to be a little bit more hands-on with Hasbro because it was they were gearing it a little more for younger age. They were trying to pull in more of a younger audience. And so we knew that we weren't going to be able to get away with as much as we could on the other books, which had more of a adult audience. So we were a little nervous about that. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't cross any lines. And we ended up crossing a line with them pretty significantly without even meaning to. This cover, to number two, got us in really hot water with Hasbro, because even though Spirit is hanging over water, they considered this a life-threatening situation and they pumped the brakes and they pumped the brakes hard, and not just on Sigma Six, it then carried over into all of the other projects as well. So that cover got us on their radar even more. We then, from that point, we were not allowed to depict anything that could cause a life-threatening situation. No characters, both in the America's Elite or in Sigma Six, they were not to be shown in any, on the covers at least, not any life-threatening situations. We were not allowed to depict anyone holding a gun.
Like on the cover for the issue you wrote, issue 19 of America's Elite.
Exactly. That the original cover of that, they had... Duke was holding a gun, And the Baroness was actually behind them in place of Serpentor, because it was meant, it was all meant to be a different storyline. And the Baroness was behind them instead of Serpentor, and she was leaping at them, I believe, with knives. And they put the kibosh on that real quick. And the tenor of Sigma Six became what they wanted the tenor of all the projects to be. And I think this was going to be my, one of my little devil's do or devil's poo moments, but they actually came to us and they said that we needed to change the way that we were thinking about G.I. Joe, that it was not about war. It was not about military. It was to be a group of friends who go on adventures together.
Okay.
So that's the thing that I remember the most. And it really, that became tough balancing that out. The feel of the Sigma Six wanting to be a little more user-friendly and kid-friendly and keeping true to the nature of what a real American hero was all about. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's, those are the things that jump out at me the most. I remember that issue two cover, the no weapons thing, and a group of friends going on adventures together.
All I can say is, wow. Mark, your turn.
I read in, as part of my research that, that you were very complimentary about the writing of the writer of Sigma Six, which was Andrew Dabb.
Yeah, very much so. He was an absolute, he was my go-to with anything. If I needed a Joe story, if I needed a Dungeons and Dragons story, the guy was, he was a workhorse and he was solid and he could write anything. And I really loved working with him. Just a real class act, really nice guy. And he never fought me if we needed to make changes, whether it was Hasbro changes or things that I thought needed to be changed. He never fought me. We would talk it out and he would listen and he would give his point of view. But ultimately he realized that he was writing a product that was owned by somebody else. And he was really good about that. I miss that guy.
Where did you find him, or how did he find you?
Boy, oh boy. My brain's probably not going to be able to pull this up too easily.
That's okay.
I don't remember if he was one that sent a submission to me and I read a story of his and liked it, or if like Tim Seeley brought him in. I honestly don't remember him, how he got involved.
There is an interview with him on the internet that I think Mark and I have read or skimmed before. Maybe several years ago, he answered that question already.
Yeah.
Mark, can I ask another Sigma Six question, or are you raring to jump back to the beginning? Okay, so this is sort of Mark's question, because Mark interviewed Chris Lai, and I want to double check we've got this. We've got this pronunciation right, because I've heard Lai and Lee.
Lee.
Oh, okay.
I always called him Chris Lee. I knew him when I was in grad school. He was an undergraduate, and that's how he got involved with things.
At SCAD.
Yeah.
At Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia. Okay.
Yes.
So how did Chris Lee, which is spelled L-I-E, how did he come to Devil's Do, and then I'll do part two after. How did he come in?
I brought him in. I needed artists, and he's solid. He's very fast, he's very good. I'm probably gonna say this about a lot of my creators. He never fought if we had to make changes. to me, that as an editor, that was a big thing, you know. People that didn't dig their heels in and throw a temper tantrum or good in my book. And I can't remember how or why, but he even was in the office for a little bit, like a month maybe. I can't remember what he was working on.
He was an intern.
That was it. Okay. He was an intern. Yeah, he was there more than a month, I guess, then. And it was just a blast to get to know him in a different way than in school. You know, you're in class, stressed out about finals or whatever, but he's a good guy. He's a really good guy. And he came through for us a lot.
Is the subtext here that a lot of artists may not necessarily have been in the office because they could have lived anywhere and mailed or scanned their artwork?
Correct. Yeah. In fact, oh boy, I mean, there are people that I worked with every day that I still have never met in person. I got to meet Joe Casey once at a convention. Like Josh Metters, he came up and stayed in in Chicago for a week or two just to do some brainstorming and draw some stuff in person with us. But for the most part, no, I never got to meet any of our artists in person. But Chris is a different game.
Mark, while we're still on Sigma 6, do you want to ask your question that you asked Blaylock last weekend?
Chris told this story to me about he was sort of working late on a Friday, hanging around in the offices for his friend to meet up with him. And a late request came through from Hasbro for some Sigma 6 designs for the toys, which Devil's Due was helping with. And because he was in the office, he was able to rush through some quick designs, give them to Josh, I guess, maybe fax them off to Hasbro, and that ultimately leading to a gig where he was, you know, working on design for Hasbro, and then consequently the comic. Do you want to tell your side of that story?
I don't remember that one specifically. I remember hearing about it. I remember while I was working at Devil's Due, Josh and his business partner also had, they had another company.
Devil's Due Creative?
No, I can't remember the name. That's it. And they were completely separate from us and what we were doing in the comics, but they were doing a lot of work for Hasbro, a lot of toy design, stuff like that. And so I believe that work was through Kunoichi, that he was doing the design work was through Kunoichi. And I know Chris did a ton of work for Kunoichi, but I spent a lot of late hours at Devil's Due. I was within walking distance of the office, and Josh may not remember this, but I was the first there and the last to leave because I love my job. Why are you shaking your head? No.
it's wonderful to live near work. It can be terrible to live near work.
Well, right now I'm sitting in my home, which is my office. So it's where I do work every day. So I actually miss.
Remote or freelancers who work from home, it can be something completely different.
Yeah.
But, you know, if everyone else, you know, drives in 5 miles or takes the subway, you know, 10 miles, but you can just walk 2 blocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh, Mike O'Sullivan, I sure need you to do the so-and-so since you'll be the first person there.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I started at Devil's Due, I've never really lost my excitement for what I do. I mean, comics is what I wanted to be involved in from as early as I can remember. I mean, honestly, like I said, G.I. Joe number one in 1982 was the first comic book I picked up alongside an Avengers comic. Number 222 was the Avengers book I picked up. And I always wanted to be in comics. And I mean, I hounded Devil's Due to get an internship. And within 2 months, I was associate editor. And within 4 or 5 months after that, I was senior editor. So I was excited. I was enthusiastic. I did not mind spending 12-hour days because I was in heaven. And on top of that, I was working on G.I. Joe. I mean, you couldn't. I still can't. There are still times that I still am like, I mean, my first job out of grad school, I got to work on my dream project. You know, I got to work on G.I. Joe, for crying out loud. I mean, that's...
Let's go back and fill in the gaps there. So you're picking up G.I. Joe issue 1 on the newsstand, 1982.
Wait, newsstand or comic book store?
I didn't even know there were such things as comic book stores. I picked it off, I think it was a drugstore in Meadow Vista, California, which is where I went to grammar school. And I walked across the street to this little country general store that was across the street. And I saw it there on this little shelf that they put their comic books on. And I was sucked in. The cover. I think I had seen a commercial for it. My parents didn't want us to get involved in the toys because in their mind, it was just, there were lots of little pieces and it was just another thing to spend money on. And they fought on that. But when I got the comic book, all the doors broke down after that. There was no holding back.
How old were you? Did you have siblings or cousins who were also into this? Did you have siblings or cousins who had been into 70s Joe?
No. I knew about it. Trying to think how. I think when just naturally, when I started getting involved and interested in it, you know, my father would say things like, oh, they used to be really big and they used to be, you know, huge and now they're small. And, you know, so I think I just kind of knew about it through fathers or an uncle maybe, but no, I didn't really have any friends who were involved in G.I. Joe. There was one other kid in grammar school, but anyway.
And you said the doors blew open. Did that mean that you, despite some resistance, you did sort of get all of the toys as yeah. well? Or
yeah, and I still have all of them. I've got all of them.
Oh, wow, great.
I kept them, and I was that kid that after I would play with them, I would I drove a couple of friends in later years nuts, but I would then go through an inventory of all of my weapons to make sure that I had not lost anything. And so I've got everything. I've got the little microphone for what was the name of the character that had the microphone? Was it Lift Ticket?
Heavy Metal, maybe.
Heavy Metal. That was it. Yep. I've still got that.
The kind of care and attention to detail sounds like it would well serve an editor later. Yes. And I don't say that in jest.
No.
How old were you when you bought issue one, and who was your first figure?
So in 1982, I would have been nine years old. My first figure, I remember it was a Christmas. It was a Christmas morning when I got my first figure. And I think I was so surprised that my parents had given in. I must have campaigned hard, because I came out and there were five or six figures. And I can't remember the specifics, but I do remember Scarlet was in there. I want to say Stalker, but I don't remember the rest. I remember being so excited that I reenacted it later that day when I went over to a friend's house. I was such a stupid kid. I still am. But I remember reenacting how excited I was when I turned the corner and there they were. And it's no wonder I don't have many friends.
If this is December of 82, presumably you also now had issues, you know, 2 through 8.
No, I found issue 1, and I don't know if just as a kid, it didn't register that it was an ongoing thing. I'm not sure why. It could have been my parents resisting they also knew that that I was a little OCD with things, that if I had one, I had to have all. So they were always reluctant to let me get involved in collecting things, because they knew it would be a torrential downpour of what I had to get. So they fought the comics for a while. And I remember issue 13, I flipped through it at a 7-Eleven. And I remember there was a scene where Scarlet was jumping out of an airplane and she was crying. And I know now it was because she thought that Snake Eyes was killed. And she had just been told by Hawk when they were leaving for this mission. And my mother wouldn't let me buy the comic because she was trying to avoid me buying more things. And it was maybe an hour later, I was telling her I was campaigning, you know, as 9-year-old, 10-year-olds do. And I was like, oh man, I don't remember, or I don't know what she was crying about, but she was crying in that panel. And I may never know, but that'll be a great way for me to play with the toys is I'll make up a story where she has something that really made her sad and she's crying and she jumps out of the airplane and she took us back to that 7-Eleven and let me buy it. And at that point, then she called a couple of places, comic stores, and one guy called her a couple of weeks later and said, I have somebody that just sold the whole collection. And we went back and she bought issues 2 through 12 for me. It must have been up by 16, 17. I was collecting the regular issues by that point. She went back and bought them all for me. And that was the first time that I knew a comic book store existed. Is this guy called, and then it was like, wow, I can get them all.
Were you watching the cartoon when it aired?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember the first miniseries came out, and it was, I want to say it was around Thanksgiving is what my memory is of it. And maybe my memories are jumbled up, because I remember in later years, they would replay the whole miniseries on Thanksgiving. And so I would always fight with my older brother and my dad to be able to watch the miniseries when they wanted to watch football. so maybe that's my later memories are combining with when the original miniseries aired. But wow, was I obsessed. I was just obsessed. It was just, oh my gosh, I'm seeing these characters on cartoon. And I remember Cover Girl, her hair was different. And why is her hair so different? And why isn't Snake Eyes involved with Scarlet, you know? And I just remember comparing it. And so my little mind was blown by alternate realities and having to come to grips with that, that not everything lined up in all aspects of something. And I think that's why I hate alternate reality stories so much now, is because I was traumatized by a kid at first that the cartoon didn't match the comics in G.I. Joe. So I think PTSD.
Larry Hama has long sort of nudged that, you know, G.I. Joe shoulda, coulda all been one from the beginning, the way mm-hmm. that, you know, Star Wars is all one. Mm-hmm. He tells the story about designing the Bucky O'Hare figures so that all the weapons can plug into their belts and all the feet have peg holes mm-hmm. and the toy looks like that. And so does the show, because it's all going to be one story. Yeah. When did you begin a regular relationship with a comic book store? And what was that comic book store?
Boy, oh boy. Junior high, I think. We ended up getting a subscription to G.I. Joe. And so it was rushed to the mailbox every day, hoping that the new issue came in the mail. And they used to send them I can't even imagine now as a collector doing this, but they would just put this, like, old grocery bags, old paper grocery bags would just be a sleeve around the comic. And that was just how it was mailed.
And it could sort of slide out, right? From the top or bottom, but the address was printed on the brown paper sleeve.
Yep. Yep. So that's how I got, you remember? Yeah.
I was subscribing. I had a comic book store, but I did subscribe to one book so I could get something in the mail. And I think I was there for the transition around 1990. I think it goes from the brown paper to, I think they came in like sealed clear poly bags.
Oh, okay.
Around, I think that transition is 90, but I could be.
Not much better. Yeah. I mean, the plastic bags or the paper wasn't much better, but.
I mean, how often was your issue just folded in half and stuffed through
yes.
the mail slot or in your mailbox?
Yeah, fairly regularly. And I've still got them. I've got all of those comics. I mean, I tend not to lose things. So I've still got all the comics. And so I could go back in my collection and look and see which were damaged. I'm not one of the guys that really collects comics for value. I read them and I love them. So if it had a little damage, I didn't mind. If it was torn in half, of course I would replace it. But anyway, so I had the subscription to Joe. And then it wasn't until junior high when I started working. I started mowing lawns and working at a horse stable, and I was making my own money. And then I would beg mom to take me to the comic book store Saturday evening. Comics and comics. Comics was spelled regularly, the first one, and then the second one was comics with an X. Comics and comics in, oh boy, I can't remember the name of the city now, but it was a little drive to the mall. And we would go there.
Is this outside of LA or outside of San Francisco?
Sacramento. Outside of Sacramento. Citrus Heights. That was the name of the city. Citrus Heights, California. It was a suburb of Sacramento, and that's where I grew up. So that was junior high that I started regularly going there. They're not in existence anymore. I think I heard they went out of business. But
And your interest in comics sort of expanded beyond just G.I. Joe to all manner of other things?
Yeah, I knew of them. I knew of comics. Like I said, Avengers 222 was the first one I picked up. But my mother put the full stop on not allowing me to read superhero comics for a long, long time. My parents were very, very hardcore religious. So she read the G.I. Joe comics with me, but it wasn't so much because she was enjoying them. She was looking for anything that would not be approved. And she would put, she had these little stickers that said Jesus saves, and she would put it over a word balloon if they had a bad word in it. Or I remember they let me look at the Shogun Warrior comics for a while in the late 70s because I liked the toys. And in the comics, their leaders had an Egyptian Ankh as their symbol. And boy, was she beside herself with that. And so she would put a cross over all of them in the comics. And we weren't allowed to watch Star Wars movies for a long time because the Force was a religion other than Jesus. I mean, it was late 70s, early 80s when it was the whole Jesus freak movement, and it was hardcore. And your mouth was washed out of soap for saying the word gosh. At least mine was. So anyway, she fought it hard.
You said you've still got your childhood copies of the comics. In your copies that you've still got now, are there little stickers on certain panels?
No, because my mother, if I ever did anything really bad, misbehaved in any way, she would destroy my comics. That was how she knew she could really get to me. But she never destroyed the Joe comics. It was always any other comics that I had. Once she kind of loosed the brakes a little bit on superhero comics, if I really acted up, I mean, this is when I was 10, 11. I mean, whatever it is that a 10 or 11-year-old does to act up. Again, I probably said gosh, or I probably said that I didn't like my brother or something. You know, I mean, they were pretty hardcore. She would destroy them. So all of those are gone. But the G.I. Joe comics, she never destroyed those, which I don't know why. I don't know why she didn't destroy those, but the others she did. Happened twice, two times, that she destroyed my whole collection.
Wow.
I carry PTSD with me everywhere, I guess.
Did you get out of G.I. Joe at a certain age? Did you get out of comics at a certain age?
Nope.
Okay, so you read G.I. Joe through 155.
Every single issue, nonstop. There were times that I lost interest. I mean, like the later Transformer crossover, that didn't make me happy. But no, I never stopped. I bought every issue off the stands, special missions, yearbook, everything.
Did you get out of the toys at a certain point?
I did. I got out of toys, I think, in high school, first year or two of high school, which would be... the toys started getting a little, I didn't really like Raptor, Big Boa, you know, they were just kind of getting weird to me. So I lost interest, but then like 89, I want to say 89, I was on a break from a job I had at a fast food restaurant, and I walked over to the store and I just walked through the toy aisle and I saw some of the toys, and I can't remember, Hit and Run, I think is the name of the character. The parachutist, camo, was that his name?
It's green and black camo. He came with a big black rucksack thing. And
face was painted.
Face paint, yeah.
And I looked at that and I thought, that's awesome. They've gone back to more military feel. And I bought all the figures in that run, and I went back and collected the other ones that I had. So I had a pretty solid, I had everything except for Admiral, because I never could afford the USS flag. I had everything for with Admiral up until like maybe 92-ish. I had all the figures. I never really cared much for the vehicles because they were just too big and unwieldy. But I had all the figures except for Admiral up until about 92. Still have them. And then I finally got Admiral in 2007.
Nice. And at what point did, in your, you know, did you think about that working in comics could potentially be something that you could do as a profession, or are we
nine
jumping ahead of ourselves?
No, 9 years old.
9 years old. Wow.
I knew that comics was what I was going to do. I just knew it. I started writing fan letters to G.I. Joe, and would get responses back. Like, I actually got a hand-drawn picture of Snake Eyes from Larry Hama in 1988. He misspelled my name, though, but whatever.
Do you have any of those postcards that he had printed up?
No.
Like Hawk, Snake Eyes, and Scarlet with like a word balloon. It's like, thanks for writing. And he might add something.
No, he actually, the only time I got anything like that from G.I. Joe, I had my letters printed in the G.I. Joe comics often.
Wow.
So I know I'm in there. I had letters printed in like Alpha Flight, New Warriors, Nova, Night Thrasher. I mean, I was prolific.
Wait, how often would you write a letter?
Every issue. I would write
for several series.
I wrote letters to G.I. Joe often as a kid, and then through high school, maybe. And then my main interest became the Marvel superhero books. And I would write a 3x5 card for every issue, and I would just send in the things that I liked, things that I didn't, suggestions. And I would send a 3x5 card to the editors of every comic that I wrote, except G.I. Joe. I don't know why I didn't. Coming back. So I wrote all these letters to G.I. Joe and never heard back until years later, like 5 years after writing letters to G.I. Joe. Larry Hama, it was a regular 8.5x11 piece of paper. He drew Snake Eyes, wrote best, or to Mike Sullivan. He left off my O apostrophe. To Mike Sullivan, best, Larry Hama, 1988. And he mailed that to me. And I've still got it. It's in my original art folder. But then through college, the editors at Marvel, if you wrote letters, they would pick, and your letter was printed, they would pick one letter from the letters page, and then they would actually send you the full art board of the letters page where they pasted it up and they had their handwritten notes and everything. And so I've got, I don't know, maybe 10 of those. You have some too?
No, I have the Larry bullpen bulletins page.
Awesome.
So, but it looks like this, right? It's a big piece of,
yeah.
Yep. A big piece of.
Exactly. Yep. I've got a bunch of letters pages of that. And then over the years as an editor, it kind of became a tradition. Artists, their thank you gift, to at least to me, and I don't know if other editors got this, but they would send me a page of the original art that they did for me. So I've got original pieces of G.I. Joe art from Tim Seeley, Mike Baer, Josh Metters. I've got a lot. So yeah, so I've got an original art collection that means a lot to me. I have the Lady J that Tim drew for her Datadesk handbook profile, because I was so traumatized when they decided to kill Lady J in the comics. I fought that hard, and I was only an assistant editor at the time. So and I think Josh wrote about that in the trade paperback for that story. He even wrote that when he announced it, that I protested and I fought him, and then gradually I came around to seeing what we could do with the storyline. I'm just rambling about stuff now. I knew that I wanted to be an editor in comics. That was it. And I
okay. So you didn't want to be a writer or an artist.
At the time, in the 80s, it was not unusual for editors to also create. So I kind of thought that I would be able to do that as well. Now the policy is that you're not allowed to. If you're a staff person at Marvel, you are not allowed to freelance. But I also knew that the only way that I was going to be able to become an editor was if I knew how to write and draw. So I went and got my master's degree in sequential art. So I can draw, I can write. But that wasn't my goal. That was my means to an end. Mark Gruenwald, still to this day, is probably my biggest role model in comics. He was the Marvel editor for decades, and he wrote the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, which I was obsessed with. And then,
and as freelance writer, had the record holding run for writing Captain America.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Gruenwald has written more issues of Cap than anyone.
Yes. Yeah.
But tragically passed away young in early
1996. There are two celebrities that their deaths caused me to cry, and Mark Gruenwald was one of them, without a doubt. Like that shocked me, because I was looking very forward to someday working with him. He had just this amazing creative. I mean, sometimes his stories were a little hokey. Yeah, sure, but he had this connection with the fans. He wrote this Mark's remarks in every issue that he edited that was just so accessible and telling us what was going on at Marvel and teaching things about how to edit and comics and why decisions were made. And he just seemed, that was what I wanted to base my entire career on. And it was him.
You're talking about he would write a bit in the letters page,
yes,
of the comics that he edited. Right. So instead, yes, of like three or four letters, there'd be one fewer and he would have the first column.
Yep.
So I have two bits of note for our listeners and readers. The first printing of the Squadron Supreme paperback collection, right? Grunewald wrote these 12 issues, and Squadron Supreme is sort of like Watchmen before Watchmen. It's superheroes in the, quote, real world and what would really happen.
Yes.
And for Marvel, for what year is it, 84, 85?
85 is when he wrote that one, yeah.
You know, plenty of Marvel in 85 was great, and plenty of Marvel in 85 was okay, and Squadron Supreme is particularly interesting. Grunewald's ashes were mixed into the ink that was used to print the first printing of the Squadron Supreme trade paperback. So one bit of trivia. Number two, Marvel fans who have been enjoying Loki on Disney Plus will note a particular character, a particular lead character on that show who is visually patterned after Mark Grunewald. And Grunewald famously wrote a bunch of like time travel theory for the Marvel universe.
Yes.
Okay, Mark, ask some question.
So I think we were still on the trajectory of you finding your way towards a career in comics. So you've done a postgraduate, and then what?
Well, once I graduated from SCAD, I went back to Chicago, which is where I was living before and after grad school. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to get into the comics community, how I was going to get a job. And I was at Graham Cracker's Comics in Chicago when I overheard somebody, and I can't remember who it is. I was trying to pick my brain, but I overheard somebody talking, and I put it together that they were an employee of Devil's Due. And I was buying the Joe comics. And so I was uncharacteristically bold. And I introduced myself and said, I want to do an internship with you. I really do. I really need this. It's very important. I would love it. And I would be a great employee. I can't remember who it was, whether it was Blaylock himself or if it was Susan Bishop. I honestly don't remember. And I'm racking my brain. A month or two passed and I didn't hear anything back, but I wrote them every week and I was persistent. And finally, Marshall Dillon got in touch with me and called me in for an interview and with he and Mark Powers. And Mark Powers was also a kind of a role model of mine. He was editing the X-Men books for a lot of years. And those were my jam. And so I saw his name and I got to meet Mark Powers. And oh my God, I was just awestruck. And they brought me in as an intern. And apparently I found out later they brought me on and nobody else knew that they were doing it. So Blaylock didn't know that I was being brought on, but I mean, it wasn't a huge deal because I mean, they weren't paying me. I was an unpaid intern. So it was kind of like, what's this person doing here? But then I started showing that I know Photoshop and I know all these things. And so I know how to edit and I know how to write and I know how to do all these things. So I started building trust more and more and more. And like I said, within 2 months, I was hired as an assistant editor. And then when Mark went back to New York, I was hired as senior editor. And I did that for a number of years. When the Joe license was taken away from Devil's Due, when Hasbro decided to give it to IDW, Josh closed the physical office, rented a smaller one. And so some staff had to work remotely. And so me, I never really fit in. I'm very high strung, or used to be very high strung. I'm not as laid back as everybody else at Devil's Due was. So I was one of the people that was chosen to work remotely just because my anxiety level would cause tension because I was stressed about getting things done. And anyway, so he made the right decision. And I had to work remote. And then while I was working remotely, a friend of mine from grad school offered me a teaching position at a college in Washington, D.C. So I took it. And so I was working full time at Devil's Due remotely, teaching college full time. And that was the end of 2008. I went remote in 2007. The end of 2008, I moved to D.C. And in mid 2009, Josh asked if I could stop by for a meeting at the office. And I said, I don't live in Chicago anymore. Since when? A year ago? And at that point, he decided okay, we're going to go a different direction with our editorial staff. And so then I lost my position as an editor at Devil's Due at that point. But by that point, I had a fan of G.I. Joe that had written letters to me as the editor. He and I became good friends, just connecting about various things, Voltron, G.I. Joe. He was an editor at Archie Comics. And by that point in early 99, he had gotten a position at Marvel. And I asked him once, hey, can you get me in front of the people that write the handbook? See if I can get in on that. And I did. I got it. I got a position as a freelance writer for the Marvel Universe handbook. So by the time that Josh let me go, I was working full-time as a freelancer for Marvel, full-time teaching college, and full-time for the It wasn't a huge loss. G.I. Joe was gone by that point.
Three lots of full-time jobs.
Yeah.
But also, after the G.I. Joe, after Devil's Due no longer has the G.I. Joe license, as a full-time editor at Devil's Due, how much was there to do?
A fair amount. We were working on some projects. In fact, I going through and pulling all my old comics out for today, I opened up the Devil's Due, my Devil's Due boxes, and you know, of course, they spiderwebs and creaks, and you know, I mean, I haven't been opened in years, but there were a lot of projects. There was a couple of alien ones, there was some horror books. I worked on Chucky and Evil Ernie, some dinosaur projects, zombie project. There was a fair amount.
Is this before the Family Guy comics?
No, Family Guy happened while I was still in the office and working on G.I. Joe. That was my first number one book was the Family Guy. And I didn't know anything about Family Guy. I never watched it. So I had to do a crash course on Family Guy when we got that license to know how to work on that project. So I had to do a crash course on Dungeons and Dragons too. So really, the only thing I knew of Devil's Due was G.I. Joe, and I knew that like the back of my hand. So I had to do some crash course stuff on learning all the others. So anyway, and so I got I wrote for the handbook for Marvel. I did that for 12 years. And then the editor of the handbooks, he knew that I had a background in this. He brought me up to the offices at Marvel a number of times to when their backlog would get really busy in the trade paperback department. And so he would bring me up and I would serve as an editor for a month or two in the office when college breaks were happening and I wasn't teaching. And then I just talked to him, I guess it was 2021. I told him that I wanted a full-time staff position. And so they worked it out that I could become a full-time staff person in the assets department. I'm converting all of our old films and paper printing stuff to digital. And I've been doing that full-time as a full-time staff person. And they made, Disney made a concession for me because I've been writing for the handbook for so long that I'm still allowed to do that. So I can't be paid for it, but I can still lead the handbook team and the research team for Marvel editorial. So like, in fact, this weekend, what we're working on is Tom Brevoort has asked me and my team to come up with a status for every mutant in the Marvel universe. So that's what my team is working on this week.
Because Tom Brevoort is now moving from being the editor of everything, the senior editor of everything, not X-Men at Marvel, to senior editor of X-Men.
Yep. And so he knows that I know the X-Men very well. And so he asked if I'd be willing to come up with a status of all mutants. So my team is working on that this week as I speak. They're all working on it now.
Okay. So the two non-G.I. Joe questions, because I'm so into the reprints and assets stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like there haven't been a lot of new Marvel handbook publications of original newer material in the last couple of years. There have been some omnibi of the 80s and 90s, the mm-hmm. original handbook or the, you know, update 89 or the master edition. Mm-hmm. So am I missing something, or are you doing stuff that's sort of so behind the scenes or long term? Because there was a whole bunch of new Marvel handbooks in like 2008
yep.
or 2010.
Yeah.
So what am I missing right now?
Well, there were a lot from the handbook came back in 2005, and we were writing constantly until about 2016. We were doing handbooks for the movies. We were doing handbooks for the comics, and that was steady, constant work from 2005 to 2016. And then they, I don't know. I don't know why. Sales were good, but I don't know why. But then it kind of petered out a little bit, 2017, 18, 19. And then 2020, I mean, we had little projects here and there. And then 2020, they wanted new ones. So we got to do three projects, an Avengers one, X-Men, can't remember the other one. Oh, Venom, Carnage, the Symbiotes. And we do constant work. We'll do profiles for the back of trade paperbacks. We'll update our work there. But mainly the thing that we do is we do a lot of research for them. Things like this Mutant project right now. They'll get in touch with us when they need a list of alternate realities where this happened, or they need a list of every alternate universe Spider-Man, or, hey, how many times has Moon Knight met Iron Fist? You know, and so we'll do a lot of that type of stuff for them. We did annotations for the Wakanda miniseries that came out. We did annotations for the history of Wakanda. So we do things like that. We're not as much as, you know, a couple of years ago, but we're in constant use.
Okay.
And ideally, fingers crossed, I would love to get the handbook somehow online, somehow on Marvel.com or something, because they would take away the overhead costs of printing and then just have us do it online, an online source. I'd love to have that, because the big problem about people using online sources is that they're not always correct. So they're not vetted. And there's actually a fan thing, and I fought this a lot during G.I. Joe. There's actually a fan thing, a competition to see who can create fan stuff, get it on a website, and then get a Marvel editor to use it in a book, making it canon. That's how Gambit now has a middle name. An editor grabbed a middle name from a fan story and made it the official middle name of Gambit. That's how one of Wolverine's kids got named. And people would try to do that with G.I. Joe too, but they didn't realize that I knew G.I. Joe too well.
It's funny. I was talking about this with Chris McLeod just today. He's got a theory that Naugahyde, the dreadnought Naugahyde, has got a pet warthog called Clyde, and he thinks that originated on Wikipedia, which then subsequently found its way into some more official sources, such as the Battle Lines card game.
I've heard that. Yep, I've heard the same thing. Because I didn't remember him ever having a name for the longest time. I think there were others, like Serpentor Snake didn't have a name. And so, you know, unless it was like marked in the box, you didn't know what the animal's name was. Shipwreck's Bird was never named, as far as I knew, for a long time. But anyway, yeah.
All right, so you are an editor in Marvel's collections department.
Yeah, I did that on temporary basis. When they needed me, I would go to New York for a month or two and do that. And then I went full-time staff 2 years ago for Marvel.
Can you talk about, all right, so I'll pick up a Marvel collection, and this is indirectly related to G.I. Joe fans, because I'm often thinking about the work that Marvel did on G.I. Joe volumes 1 through 5, which reprinted the first 50 issues, mm-hmm. which Marvel published around 2002, which IDW then republished as classic G.I. Joe volumes 1 through 5. Those look great. And I think classic G.I. Joe volumes 6 through 15 don't look great.
Right.
And that's a whole paragraph that takes a big inhalation of air.
Scan the actual comics and just print the scans? I remember
they scanned comics, they stripped the color and then recolored it.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the films, I guess that's the best you can do. I don't know, unless there was an entire internet of fans who owned a lot of that original art who might scan the art for you. I don't know. I'm just a fan who's sitting on some art. Anyway.
Bravo.
So, all right. So I'll pick up a Marvel collection, and I will note that some of the pages look great and some of the pages look very good. Or I'll note in the back that there's a scan of the original art, and often it says courtesy of, you know, a person or one of the auction sites, and I'll think, oh, they went back to the source. They didn't go back to like an unwieldy, perhaps out of focus film negative or positive of the original page from 30 years ago. So can you talk a little bit, about asset management in creating the highest quality version of a reprint and choices you make or compromises you make?
Sure. We have a company in St. Louis that is a vendor that has all of our films from 1939 to about early 90s. And then it starts getting sporadic until about 97, 98, 99, because that's when things started going digitally. So they have all of our files.
When you say files, you mean 11 by 17 films of each page?
Yes.
A photograph of the black and white original.
Yes. They've got, depending on the project, they've got films, they've got paper prints of what was made of from the printer. So they've got all of that. I mean, the original art is dispersed. You know, it used to go back to the artists, and who knows where all of that is. You know, it's been circulating for decades.
Or it wouldn't go back to the artists.
Sometimes. But over the years, of course, things have gotten lost. Things have gotten damaged. Things have gotten destroyed, you know, various things. I have a master list of what they have, and it's my job to go through it. And I've categorized it by what's more likely to be reprinted, what's second stage, maybe we'll reprint this someday, and then the ones that are most likely won't be able to reprint, or they're just not an interest, like the romance comics of the 50s, or you know, some of the horror comics of the early 40s, that sort of thing. So what we do is we have, I'm probably over explaining things. If it's before.
No, you're not. Okay. For Mark, maybe. For half our listeners, for me, no. Please continue.
All right. If it's before 1990, we have them do a 600 DPI scan of what they have for a comic in black and white. And then we have it recolored. If it's after 1990, when color processes started getting a lot better, started getting more impressive and used shading and tones, we have them do a 600 DPI scan of the color films. And so we have them in fours, and then we combine those, and then we've got the full thing. But if it's before 1990, it's black and white, and then we get them recolored. And the goal is to get everything digitized so we've got the entire backlog.
I note on Age of Apocalypse, there are some 90s comics where in paperback now it looks like pages are scanned from printed comics, and I figure, oh well, that was colored in Photoshop in, you know, 1996. They must not have those files anymore.
There are cases like that. We're putting together a, I don't think I'm getting any trouble for this because there's a Wolverine omnibus series that's coming out right now. We're doing a lot of things like that. And there was an issue in a volume of Wolverine that we just don't have. We don't have it in our digital files. My vendor in St. Louis doesn't have it. We just do not have it anywhere. So in a case like that, we do have to do very high quality scans, high resolution version scans of the comic itself, strip the color, have the black line work recreated, and then have it recolored. The processes are so good now that you can't necessarily tell, but even 6 years ago, they weren't as good as they are now. So there were times that things snuck through.
Sometimes I'll see a moiré pattern
on
the color, and I'll think, okay, that's from a printed comic, but maybe that's from 6 years ago.
Exactly. Part of my job also is going through the files that we have, even from up to 10 years ago that are digital, and going through those and finding things that are not quality and getting them rescanned. So yes, we have digital versions of, say, the Age of Apocalypse stuff. but I open them up and it turns out they're 300 DPI and they should be 600. So my job then is to recreate those, get those scanned again and replace those for the next time they're reprinted. Then we have 600 DPI scans. And then if they're going for a master's work project, we do those in 1200 DPI. So yes, there are things in the past that haven't been so great. We're working on replacing those. We're working on getting those recreated.
I'm gonna half shift gears. And after this one question, I promise, Mark, we can ask a G.I. Joe question. And this is laterally related to G.I. Joe. This is a cousin of G.I. Joe. Can Marvel reprint Nth Man?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. It's not that Marvel can't reprint Nth Man. It's that at the moment, Marvel isn't. Because it sort of looks, it's like Wolfpack. Like Wolfpack got reprinted, mm-hmm. right? You know, there's, you know, like all the Star books, the like Star books that looked, if you squinted, a lot like Archie mm-hmm. books.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not like an ownership thing. It's a gauging interest thing. Marvel could reprint Nth Man.
As far as I know, yes. Now, okay. Of course, I'm not in legal, and you get even more complex now that we're owned by Disney. And let me tell you, those Disney's lawyers, good. God almighty, Crimson Guardsmen. Like, you do not mess with Disney loyal legal. So there could be something somewhere that I don't know about, but I just converted all of them to digital format 4 months ago.
Oh, well, if you need a scan of the cover to 16, I know the guy who owns it.
That's great. So yeah, that was on my list and we just did those.
It's me.
I figured.
I've sort of wondered if at some point Marvel in the last 10 years thought that there was a creator participation or some kind of creator ownership. And in speaking casually to Larry Hama and Ron Wagner, there isn't. So with so many sort of middle tier things from the late 80s and 80s reprinted at Marvel, I sort of wondered, is Marvel incorrect and Marvel thinks it can't reprint Ant-Man? Could Marvel sure could.
We're finding that there's interest in just about anything being reprinted. I mean, we're reprinting ROM, for crying out loud, and Micronauts, and those definitely have ownership issues. Eventually, everything comes around, and I'm betting that someday we'd have an Nth Man reprinting. Somebody somewhere will want it. So,
I sure hope Marvel would spring for commissioning a new cover by the guy who drew the series originally, because he's around. Okay, anyway.
Let me grab something.
Mark's gonna grab an impressive object.
Okay.
If Marvel doesn't make omnibuses of these great things themselves, then people take it in their own hands to just make their own.
Oh, that's awesome.
There's my custom bound Nth Man.
That's fantastic. and that's actually in the actual Marvel offices. That is physically how our books are stored in our library. Is we have like Amazing Spider-Man. We've got 20 issues in the first volume, the issues 21 through 40 in the next one, and they're hardbound like that in our library.
You're talking about the original comics.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Man, I am so sorry. I feel like I'm taking you guys everywhere but where we intended to go. But I could talk about this stuff all day, every day.
Sorry, in another life, I would want to be a Marvel editor. So this is interesting for me. I think Mark wants to ask some G.I. Joe questions.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. How about it?
We met Ron Wagner this weekend.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. That's so cool. Sketchbook.
That was done this time last week.
You know what? I should, maybe before the end of the call, I've got my original art behind us. In fact, you know, let me just grab it right now. I think you guys would be interested in this.
Here, here.
All right. I'll spare you the non-G.I. Joe stuff for now. Okay.
Hey, it's the Larry Hama sketch that you mentioned.
Right. Not all that different from his modern convention sketches.
Yeah. Wow. 1988. And
Who added the O?
I was just about to point that out. Yep, that would be, you know, that would be 14-year-old me thinking, you know, that would be the way to solve it. All right, so original art that I have for G.I. Joe. I don't know if you ever saw, heard about this. The last issue of our comic.
We did
a special cover that was just 50 copies of this cover for G.I. Joe 36, America's Elite 36. We printed 50 copies, and it was meant to just be a gift to Devil's Due friends and family. I took 10 copies, gave them to all of the creators of the issue, and then somehow the box that was at the Devil's Due office got destroyed. So there are only like 10 to 12 copies of this comic in existence. And last night, as I was gathering my stuff for this, somehow I have three of them. I've got one that I kept for me, one that I need to send to Phil Cost, and then somehow I have a third copy that I didn't even know I have. So I've got a copy here that, you know, maybe I should sell to the highest bidder. Who knows?
Or donate to your favorite G.I. Joe podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But I've got the original headshots that I drew for, I'm trying to get the So I've got the headshots that I drew. Rob Atkins inked them over my pencils.
And then who drew Colton?
Mark Powers drew Colton.
Wow.
I inked the Colton. Let's see, what else can I tell you about this? I also drew the Josh Blaylock in the upper corner. I built the cover. I did all of the actual graphic design, placing of the heads.
Right. Reworking in Photoshop.
Who colored the cover?
Wes DiZioba did the colors on this one.
Okay. Wes, who had colored a bunch of G.I. Joe for Devil's Due.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I even colored the figure of Blaylock up in the corner. I think I did the colors on that one. So, yeah. So this was a big jam. And it was neat to ink Mark's figure. I got to do that. And then, you know, see my pencil. Anyway, so I've got the pencils for that, which I love. Here is Tim Seeley's original pencils of the Lady J figure from her Dado Desk profile. He gave that to me knowing that I was, you know, I hated killing her off. Here is the original art of Airtight. Airtight?
Yeah. And then Sparks?
Yeah.
And Sparks.
Airtight Sparks, yeah.
Sparks. The reason I have this is because of Sparks. Sparks became my favorite character. Honestly, the way that we worked him into America's Elite and all those stories, he became my absolute favorite character. I even had a fan even gave me, in exchange for a hand-drawn, I drew a picture of Cobra Commander for him. He made a custom figure of Sparks for me.
Nice.
And I've got that somewhere. Here's a page from issue 21 of America's Elite by Mike Baer. I love this page just because, I mean, I loved putting these little details back into the comics of Cobra Commander shooting pictures of the Joes, you know. And I just love that image of Cobra Commander's face. Love that. Original art from X-Men 414, whatever.
Is that Kia Asamiya?
No.
That's Sean Phillips.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've got his original art from that issue.
We interviewed Joe Casey, and I already know the answer to the question, which is why I didn't ask it. Also, this is a G.I. Joe podcast, but the question is, how the hell did you get Sean Phillips to draw X-Men, right? Not like, did you convince Sean Phillips? It's how did you convince Marvel editorial? And the answer was like, no, Marvel was really experimental at that time. And somebody who did not have a hot, flashy style like Sean Phillips, who'd been doing Vertigo books, right? Up until then, it's like, no, he can draw X-Men for 20 issues.
Yeah. Yeah. That was Axel Alonso as the editor in chief. He was really into that experimental stuff. I've got Emily Stone drew a page from Hack Slash. She gave that to me. Here is Snake Eyes seeing Storm Shadow from the Snake Eyes Declassified series.
That looks like Atkins.
It is. I went to grad school with Rob. That's how he got into drawing G.I. Joe. I brought him in.
Okay.
Because he's a good friend of mine. He also gave me the page before it from that series.
Do you remember discussions at Devil's Due about shooting or scanning from pencils only? to save money, to save time?
Yeah, that was a Josh Blaylock decision. We would have the figures inked and any items that were in the foreground near the figures, those were inked, and then everything else was straight to pencils to colorist. Now Marvel does this too, but he even stopped using higher quality paper for the cover. The covers were just the same quality as the interior pages. Marvel does that now too, because the paper is pretty much the same quality anyway. But I remember for a while there at the beginning, they weren't so great. But yeah, that was to save cost. And then I've got Tim's drawing of Spirit. That was his profile image. But that's just some of the stuff that I've got in my little background, my little history.
What's the money behind you on the wall, and what's the O'Sullivan's? Is that a t-shirt? Is that a record label?
It's actually a, I love this wall. It's the first dollar I made as a cartoonist, first dollar I made in comics, first dollar I made at Marvel, and then just somebody gave me a dollar. I just put it up there. This is a polo shirt from the O'Sullivan's restaurant in Paris. It's right next door to the Moulin Rouge, and I got to go there. And anyway, we managed to get one of the employees to give us his actual polo shirt uniform.
This is not related to your family. Literally, no. This is a fun coincidence.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then this is interesting. Rob Atkins was inking for, see if I can get it there. Rob Atkins was doing some background inks for a guy that was Randy Green.
Yeah.
And he was doing a book called New Excalibur. And so Rob was helping him out on inks. Rob scanned the pencils of this figure of Lockheed, my favorite Marvel character, Lockheed and Kitty Pryde. Rob sent me the scan of the pencils. I did those inks right there, and then Rob put it into the inks of the issue that was printed. So technically I have a drawing of Lockheed in a Marvel comic. And then Tim Seeley ended up working on an issue of New Exiles, and it was a bunch of Kitty Pryde, alternate reality Kitty Pryde. So he drew me as Kitty Pryde in one of the backgrounds. another issue of Hack Slash, somebody drew me getting killed. It's fun. I've got all sorts of fun stuff like that. It's neat.
Thank you for sharing your arts. I imagine Mark is already thinking of how to lop that off as a like separate, smaller bonus episode. No, in a good way, because we have done episodes of this where we just have an art collector hold up their art collection one at a time.
Neat. That's neat. And I am going all over the map, you guys, and I'm sorry. Can you tell that I work from home and I don't really get to interact with people all that much?
Perfect. Just before we started, you held up a clipboard, which was just very intriguing. And you said it was stolen from the Devil's Due offices or something. What's on the clipboard?
I wrote down a bunch of things that I thought that I wanted to make sure that I got to tell you guys that were just interesting things as we go through the G.I. Joe stuff. I wanted to remember, because you start talking about stuff like this and at the end you're like, oh, I forgot to tell him that story. I forgot to tell him that story, you know.
Oh, they kept asking me about Nth Man. I didn't work on Nth Man. That's 1989.
Oh, I love it though. I mean, man, I'm having the time of my life here. But I just wrote down some things that I thought would be interesting. Like the first book that I edited myself solo, my first solo editing project was the Arashikaji Showdown.
Wow. Okay.
That was my first one. Mark Powers was just really, really busy, couldn't handle the workload. And so here I was, an assistant editor, and I got to do this. So a little warm place in my heart for this one. I know fans didn't like how the story ended with the magical stone and everything, but I'm fond of it.
If I'm remembering correctly, an element of that sort of shows up in the Snake Eyes movie, right? Like, we all saw the Snake Eyes movie, right? And didn't Blaylock refer to that, Mark, when we interviewed him a year and a half ago?
Yeah, with the magical MacGuffin stone from this book saw its way into the Snake Eyes movie.
Now, we don't have proof. We don't have proof that the screenwriters of the Snake Eyes movie definitely pulled it from that. They may have come up with it on their own, but but it is
it's a hell of a coincidence.
Yes.
Well, I have to admit, I have not seen the Snake Eyes movie.
It's okay.
Sorry,
you're not missing much.
Reread this and then watch it. But as I was told the story by Chris Lai, I think originally the lead artist was going to be Tony Tamai on this,
yes.
And he was struggling with the deadline.
Yes.
And then Chris Lai was brought in and was told to do this graphic novel in the space of about a week. Is that how you remember it?
It is indeed. It was just nuts. That's right. Yeah, the artist just was not turning in pages. He just disappeared. And that was before the project came to me. And Mark was just banging his head against the wall about how to get it done. And my memory is a little bit foggy, but I want to say that I got Chris involved in that. I don't know. He was an intern at the time, but I think I pushed him to show us his artwork. And I think that's how he got it. I could be misremembering. I could be. Anything good that happened at Devil's Due, it was me. Let's just say that.
I feel like a sort of broad and specific question that we haven't asked, which is, can you talk about the writing you have done for Devil's Due? So the Data Desk profiles, right? Mm-hmm. You talked about your Marvel Universe handbook. How did you end up writing G.I. Joe? Why not more? How was it working on it? How did they come about?
Dream come true, really. The first, how did it happen?
Because it was Special Missions was first.
No, actually the first was Lady J's Funeral. That was my first, that was my first published writing. There's a 5-page backup story in here of Lady J's Funeral.
Trade paperback only.
Yep, trade paperback only. And I wrote that.
I have never read that because I don't own that trade paperback.
You should get it. It's an amazing backup story. It just is. I mean, I was actually really proud of this. Very proud of it. I got to create a lot of the background of Flint and Lady J's romance. I had panels drawn from the Marvel series where they appeared together, but scenes that you hadn't seen before. I'm just very proud of this one. That was my first. We had pages that needed to be filled in this trade paperback. And it was like, what are we going to fill it with? And I said, hey, let me just write a funeral. And Josh agreed.
Can you clarify that for our listeners? I know what it means. What does it mean when you say we had pages that needed to be filled in the trade paperback?
Sure. Trade paperbacks, when you're printing, they need to come in, at least in the past, they need to come in groups of 8. The pages do. So if you have like a book that you want to reprint and it's say 9 pages, you basically have to print a book of 16 pages.
Or cut one, which no one would do.
Right. Exactly. Nobody wants to do that. So when we were putting this trade paperback together of the Red Shadow story, we had to have a certain amount of pages to fill because the material wasn't enough to fill all the pages that we had. So I got to write that story. And then we threw in things like an unused page from the comic, got to do some more Data Desk handbook profiles. And that's how we filled the pages up on that book.
Was there a discussion, because you referred before to the Larry Hama, Ron Wagner 5 pages that were added to the Snake Eyes Declassified collection. How much of the discussion was, if we add something to the collection, we'll goose sales on the collection?
I'm sure that was on Josh Blaylock's mind because he's really good at things like that, figuring out how to bring more money in. But for me, it was, I just want an excuse to work with Larry Hama. I just want to have and get Ron Wagner involved. Snake Eyes Declassified, that was my baby. I designed the covers. The whole cover scheme was me coming up with the black and white covers with just a red element. I actually did the sketches for all the covers. I came up with the idea of doing the annotations in the back of just noting where all the characters came from. And so when that trade paperback was happening, I just wanted it to be just a package that I could just be absolutely proud of. And that was what I came up with and suggested, and Josh went for it. You can see this is my working copy The post-it notes, if you see post-it notes in any of my stuff, it's changes that need to be made for the next printing that we did. So I've got post-it notes here that were changes we needed to make for the hardcover edition that came out after this one.
What does that say? Huh. It's covering an era and flight?
No, it says for page one, panel six, JPEG. I honestly don't remember what I wrote.
Wow.
What that was about. But there was something that needed to be changed with that. Same thing here.
Wow.
Let me see if I can find a note that does make sense.
Was there any concern that in adding exclusive content to a collection, that rather than increasing interest, you were turning off fans who had already bought it once?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. And we heard about it. We did. Hmm. We heard about it. But Blaylock likes money. Hmm. I mean, any business owner does. You know, it's not just Josh. You know, we had to stay in business. And yeah, fans get annoyed by that, but then they also kind of secretly love it when there's new material, you know. So,
well, while we're talking about specific edits and notes on trade paperbacks, here's a very specific question. There was an issue where Major Blood and Storm Shadow are fighting on the Sydney Opera House in Joe Casey's America's Elite run, maybe issue 9-ish. And in the trade paperback collection version of that, I think I'm getting this the right way around, he was assassinating someone that looked very much like the vice president in real life with a bald head, whereas I think the single issue, he didn't. Does this ring a bell, this edit?
It doesn't, actually, and I'm sorry it doesn't. I do not remember that. Was Mark still? No, Mark was gone by this point. So whatever that was me. But I'll have to dig the copies up. Oh, okay, this.
Yeah, that's right. That panel and the
you're
guy.
Saying it's different in the trade.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can. I wanted to be ready for you guys.
We have never had an interviewee so prepared.
Oh my gosh, I brought everything. I have all of the variant covers of my runs. I've got trade paperbacks. I've got everything. So let's see if I can find that page. Oh, okay, here it is. I don't see any difference.
Oh, maybe it's a different edition. Does he look exactly the same? He's got hair.
Yeah.
Huh, it is the same.
Maybe it was the IDW printing. Where
maybe.
This thing.
That could be it.
Huh.
Because IDW did make changes that were really annoying.
Mark from the future just interrupting this interview to note that after the interview, I shared an image from the IDW collection with Mike. He said it must have been someone at IDW wanting to create an in-joke or make it more realistic by making it look like Dick Cheney. It definitely wasn't us. I absolutely hate seeing real politicians used in comics because it creates an unnecessary dating of the project and can serve to polarize fans. Thanks for sharing it. It is another oddity that IDW has done with the work.
Here are some interesting stories. Speaking of IDW, Hasbro really wanted us to get big names on the book. Alex Ross said no. Mike Zeck said that he couldn't do it at the time. I got Adam Hughes. I got Adam Hughes to do a cover. But when the art came in, Hasbro freaked out because the Baroness was in a pose that just was, in their words, too suggestive. It was too sexual because she was standing back holding guns on her hips. And they told us there's no way that could ever see print and blah, blah, blah. And we still had to pay Adam Hughes for it. And Josh Blaylock, of course, was very mad at me that I didn't get everything pre-approved, and rightfully so. I wasn't able to get a sketch for the cover approved from Hasbro, but I thought they specifically asked for Adam Hughes. They know what kind of work he does. And they suggested Baroness as a cover. And then they were the ones that turned it down. And so that was kind of a sore spot for me, is that we never got to use that cover. And they told us it wasn't, and we had to pay for it and everything. And then IDW gets to print it. Just annoying that years later, Hasbro then gives them the art and says, oh, here, use this. It's like, oh, come on, guys. Seriously?
All it takes is a couple of years later, a different decision maker, a different point person at Hasbro who,
right,
you know, has a different sensibility.
Exactly. This cover.
Okay, this is the R Black cover to America's Elite issue 4 with Scarlet.
Got us in real big hot water. You know why?
Because she's blowing dice. She's blowing snake eyes.
Blowing yep. snake eyes.
Which is what yep. which is what you do when you play craps.
Exactly.
I've never played craps, but I've seen a lot of movies and TV shows where someone yep. asks someone to,
yep.
to exhale a focused puff of air on
yes.
two small cubes in someone else's
right.
head.
And Hasbro approved it. They approved the sketch. They approved the art. They approved the issue. And it wasn't until like maybe 3 months afterward that somebody at Hasbro in a meeting said, oh, she's blowing snake eyes. And they freaked out on us. That's why in any trade paperback that includes that issue or includes like all of our covers and like a big collage of covers, that one's not there. Because they told us we were never allowed to reprint that cover in any form. The only time we did is on that special cover that I did of the Joe 36. Got I put it. It on the back.
So we have focused not unreasonably on some of the stresses of mm-hmm. working with the licensor. Do you have any fun or surprising stories of working with Hasbro? Did you go to Hasbro? Did Hasbro come to Chicago? Did you meet up at conventions? Were there occasional, you know, synergies or like good connections? Because I think it can be easy to remember the headaches.
And, yeah.
So any fun stuff?
Lots of fun stuff. And it is easier to talk about the bad stuff because you know, 100 people in a room, 99 people love you, one doesn't, you remember that one. So it is easier to remember the negative stories. But the people that I worked with at Hasbro were phenomenal. They were so kind and they were on board with what we were doing. You know, they had people above them telling them G.I. Joe is too violent, tone it down. So it was great working with them. I can't remember her name and I wish I could. I really feel bad about that. But the woman that was in charge of G.I. Joe really worked with us to find ways of getting around those ridiculous things. And she was on board with our ideas. We lost the Joe license and she advocated for us to be able to finish printing the World War III story. So we didn't have the license for the last 7 issues of that story. And she fought for us to be able to finish our story because she knew how much we put into that and how badly we wanted that to be a magnum opus of our G.I. Joe run.
Okay, so you had presumably pitched and gotten approved a 12-part story that would take a year. And
yes.
But knowing that 5 months in, your license would either be renewed, would either end or would be renewed.
I never knew. Okay. I never knew that.
That's a step above you.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we proposed World War III as the 12 issues, the overall arc, and then we had to submit individual issues to be approved as such. And then it was a total surprise to me that we lost the license. It was a surprise to all of us. I think even to Josh, I think he was blown away that we didn't get it back. The Transformers movie was what really made that decision for Hasbro. They just wanted to make more money. And they were thinking the G.I. Joe movie was going to be the same nuclear bomb, huge cultural moment as the Transformers movie was. So when we lost the license and this woman at Hasbro really advocated that for us to be able to finish our story, we had to rework a lot of World War III, how it ended, where, you know, to bring things to a natural conclusion rather than being the launching point for the next couple of years of storytelling, all of that. So that's probably the most special moment for me was just her letting us do that. Because World War III, I'm incredibly proud of that story. I really, as a Joe fan, that was the type of story that I wanted to see. I wanted to have one that included everybody and was just huge in scope and things happened that actually affected characters. And and it was a multi-part story with really cool covers. And so it was really great that she let us finish, that she fought for us. So that's probably the crown jewel of the good moments that I had with Hasbro. Going there was incredible, getting to go to a licensor convention at Hasbro and see the offices and talk with all the people that make G.I. Joe toys and be treated like a rock star. It was great. It was really neat. There, though, I have a lot of those good memories too. So I don't mean to make it sound like it was a nightmare. It wasn't.
I think we're also interested in the friction because that makes for interesting stories and, you know, sometimes explains things that sort of are tickling you in the back of your mind.
Yes. Another one that I'll tell you about also, another one that's really, and rightfully so, I wanted to push the envelope a little bit and really establish Cobra Commander and the Plague as just vile villains. So in the Special Missions, The Enemy, I wrote a backup story that was actually the prologue to World War III, where Cobra Commander is recruiting the last of the Plague characters. And in that story, I looked at it again last night. It just seems like, okay, two characters that were sent on this mission to steal Desteron Baroness's baby are balking at them kidnapping a baby. And I tried to make it as big of a deal as possible that they questioned Cobra Commander's orders. And so Cobra Commander had them killed. In the original story, they were balking at the Plague killing all of the babies that were in the nursery once they got Cobra Commander's baby out of there. Because I really wanted it to be vile. I wanted Cobra Commander before this World War III story and the Plague to be set up as, I mean, what worse could a villain do? Seriously. And so I really wanted that. Hasbro rightfully said no. It was off panel. It was off panel. You didn't see it. You just saw a sound effect of gunshots. But it was a step too far. Rightfully so. But I really wanted Cobra Commander to be evil. And that's an example of where they came back and they were like, no, can't do that. So we reworked the story a little bit that they weren't protesting the babies being killed, just protesting the kidnapping of a baby. And it was their going against Cobra Commander's orders that got them killed rather than them trying to stop the murders.
There was a comic pack, some action figures that Hasbro released that, and instead of reprinting an old Marvel issue, it had an idea. It had a Devil's Due issue.
Oh yeah.
Was there a Devil's Due G.I. Joe comic that was like a public safety announcement about like fire safety?
Yes.
Firefighters and smoke alarms.
Yep. That was a Kunoichi thing. Kunoichi was hired to do that. And so they pulled me in to get the art, the story written and drawn and everything. And it went out as, yeah. And we did a version in Spanish and we did a version in Polish a couple years ago. I found that I had extra copies of those. So I sold them on eBay.
So are there other interesting or surprising connections between Devil's Due and Hasbro that you can recall? I know this is a general question, but in the way that comic is sort of unusual, or maybe I'm even thinking of, you know, like the format of the digest black and white graphic novel where Hasbro was having Devil's Due do something novel or different, or Devil's Due was experimenting with something different. Because what strikes me about the whole story of Devil's Due is that everyone who works there is young and the company is tiny. And G.I. Joe as a brand is at a different place in 2001, 2002 than it was the whole time it was at Marvel. So maybe my question, if you don't have a specific, you know, fun detail about, you know, another Hasbro Devil's Due synergy is, you know, can you reflect on your time at Devil's Due and your time working with Hasbro? Because everyone was so young, for example.
Hasbro, as much as they have to protect their properties, they were willing to experiment. Like the idea of doing a manga-sized book in the Arashikaji Showdown was to do a manga was suggested by Josh, by Blaylock. And they went for it. They were okay with it. They were okay with us doing extra things and to suggest new ventures and new ways of doing things. And they were on board with that as long as we didn't do any damage to the property itself. There was never any pressure from them to use, except for Sigma Six, there was never any pressure to do anything where we had to use figures or characters or toys, anything like that. They just said, tell good stories and, you know, do our characters proud, sort of a thing. Sigma Six was different. It was meant to be a toy tie-in, without a doubt. Can't think of anything specific that answers your question more than that. I really enjoyed working with Hasbro. I really did. I was the front line for them, good and bad. Josh was the front line for business stuff. I was the front line for creative stuff. They were totally fine if we wanted to do special covers or variant covers. Yeah, really, the only time that it came back and bit me on the ass was the Adam Hughes thing, really.
Were you involved in the later Transformers crossovers?
Yes, the last two. I came into Devil's Due as the second miniseries had, like, one issue was still in the works, so I didn't really take part in that one. But the last two, I was the editor for those two, I was. And those were fun. Me, personally, I hate alternate reality stories. I just do. I find them to be a cop-out. Like, if you really want to do dramatic storytelling that has lasting effects on characters, tell it in the main storyline, you know, take a chance, be bold. But people want to do it in an alternate reality because it doesn't really affect the characters long range. And I just think it waters down the main project. That's just my opinion. But it was fun working on those series because Transformers was another big thing for me as a kid. And so it was fun just to kind of shut down like I did with Sigma Six, not worry so much about story or about continuity, and just get to see really cool robots being drawn. That was awesome. That was neat to be a part of that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as well as the Transformers, you sort of came on board in editorial towards the end of G.I. Joe Reloaded, that experiment. Any thoughts on that?
Alternate reality. I hated the Ultimate line at Marvel. I thought it was bad to do it. Yes, it made a lot of money, so great. It supported the company, helped bring the comic industry back to life. Okay, cool. But I just hate it I'm a purist. I'm a continuity guy. I like tracing history, and I love the fact that, you know, Marvel's storyline is the longest running mythology ever. You know, there hasn't been a reboot of continuity. G.I. Joe. You know, I like that. So alternate realities, not my thing. And luckily I didn't have to work on the Reloaded thing too much. I think I helped process some art and help with letters, pages, things like that. But I didn't really have to take part in it too much. But I would if I was told to, I would. That's the job. But inside I'd be cringing.
Yeah. So you were telling us some facts about, or some anecdotes about working with Hasbro, but I did ask you if you had any true or slightly unbelievable or false stories that you could share with us for Devil's Due or Devil's Poo. So this is where you can tell us a fact which may or may not be true, and we have to try and guess whether it's something that is slightly unbelievable but actually happened, or is just completely made up.
Oh boy. See, as a person that just sits here
we can skip it.
Well, I got so excited about telling you guys all my stories. I used all the options that I had for Devil's Due or Devil's Poo. The story getting banned, or the cover getting banned for oral sex, no weapons, guns, being told that G.I. Joe is a group of friends that go on adventures. That was my main one. The Baroness cover. I blew it. I'm sorry.
No worries. You mentioned, you were describing something as nuclear earlier, and that sort of just rung a bell with me because when we were talking about, when we were looking at back at towards the end of the initial, run before it was rebooted as America's Elite, there was this explosive storyline where the Joes drop a nuclear bomb on Cobra Island. Do you remember that being a slightly controversial decision to make as a in storytelling?
Not really. I don't remember there being too much of a, there were no red flags about that. I don't remember there being any brouhaha over that. Killing Lady J was a big one. That was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't remember the nuclear bomb being something that that people were nervous about or anything like that.
And I guess those last few issues, you was you know, it was towards you being brought in as an editorial assistant, and then it, what seemed to be quite a quick transition to you being the full-blown editor, as well as that Brandon Jerwet arc all getting wrapped up, ready for a kind of that soft reboot with the mm-hmm. America's Elite. What can you tell us about that kind of that transition for you as into the editorial role, but as well as the you know, wrapping up that that Brandon Jerwet era of the book?
It was really interesting because I was just kind of a fly on the wall for the first few issues of Joe, where I was at Devil's Due, the late 30s. And then once Mark Powers knew me more and knew that I knew what I was talking about with editing, with storytelling, with, and especially with G.I. Joe, he started coming to me with more projects, and letting me have more influence. Mark Powers is the greatest mentor a person could ever have. He took me under his wing in areas that I needed it and then just let me fly. Like the Snake Eyes miniseries, he saw that I had such a passion for that, and he was just like, hey, you've not proven yourself, but show us what you got with covers. What can you come up with? How can we, you know, how can we tie this together? He was letting me read the scripts and watch for continuity hiccups. And I think I came up with the ending of him saying, Charlie, Mike, continue the mission, you know, and that was, he trusted me with that. And that was great. But he kept a safety net under me if I ever needed it, which was fantastic. By the time that Mark announced he was leaving, America's Elite had already been started and Joe Casey was already instilled and everything had been plotted out to issue 12. So I think I was coming in kind of as a sous chef for all of that. I was just kind of keeping the main course going. I was offering suggestions, designing covers, helping Joe Casey know where he could introduce things that were little Easter eggs, things like that. But I really did not get to take over and have my vision be really instilled until around issue 13 was really where I kind of felt like I was in charge, that I was calling shots and that I was really getting to influence things. The Phoenix Squad was, that was the first thing that I feel was kind of my baby.
And that was teed up by the Hunt for Cobra Commander that you wrote.
Yes. Yeah. And drew the cover for it, by the way. I got to draw that cover. I'm proud of
yes.
that one.
Oh, yes.
It's just a pair of eyes, but still, I have a cover out there. Yay.
Who said we should do a 25-cent issue? And who said I should write that issue or this guy should write that issue?
It was probably Josh and Susan that came up with the idea, you know, just a way to get. Yeah, it was a brilliant idea. You know, I mean, Marvel had done a couple of 25-cent issues, and then Marvel and DC did that competition where Marvel then put, or DC put out a 10-cent issue, then Marvel put out a 9-cent issue. And, you know, it's a great way to get somebody who's just casually looking at a book to be like, eh, it's a quarter, whatever. So it was a great marketing idea. I think I hired myself for that story. I knew what was coming up. I knew what we wanted to do with Spirit. I knew what we wanted to do with Cobra Commander. You know, I had the background knowledge of where, of little bits. And that was what I love so much about my backup stories and in Special Missions and the Hunt for Cobra Commander is that I was able to do things that incorporated elements that enhanced the bigger picture because I had the bigger picture. You know, I was able to do things that set up a storyline that was going to happen 6 months from now. And that was part of the fun. I personally think that America's Elite 13 through 36, the Data Days Handbook, Hunt for Cobra Commander, Scarlet, Declassified, the Special Missions, to me, that's what comics should be. Everything you pick up ties into the bigger picture, that there's just a consistent whole, that there's something that just, nothing is throwaway. You know, that you can pick up an issue and it's self-contained and you get an entertaining story, but it contributes to the bigger picture. And to me, that's what I feel is great about comics, is that you just have this whole world that you're contributing to with every bit. And that's what I wanted. I wanted there to be Easter eggs in everything that you picked up. I wanted there to be something for new fans and something for the stalwart old fans. You know, I wanted there to be something for everybody. And that's what I worked hard on doing. The map for World War III, where every Joe is listed and where they are in the world, that was me staying up until 4 or 5 in the morning, just having a blast, just with a world map in front of me, a list of all the Joe characters, and just having a ball putting that together. And that's what I loved so much about that whole run of G.I. Joe, is being able to do little things like that.
You talk about the map, so it puts me in mind, and I think I've got a photo of this, maybe from Josh Blaylock or maybe Chris Crank, of the Devil's Due offices, and there's a wall, and I think this is something that you did, like a war room, where you'd have each month what's coming out and a picture of the cover, and it very much looked like you were planning out this peak period, sort of. Where we're kind of at the moment, around about issue 20, like there'd be multiple things coming out each month. There'd be a declassified, a special missions or something like that. So we're really getting some solid G.I. Joe every month as readers in this period. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was a blank wall that was behind my desk. And that was out of, to be honest, that wall was out of sheer desperation for me. Josh loved alternate covers. He loved them. And they were a nightmare for me. Every issue that Devil's Due did, whether it was Zombie or Chucky or Evil Ernie, G.I. Joe, had multiple covers. I couldn't keep them straight. And I was the guy that was in charge of hiring the artists and getting the covers and getting the art done. And I was losing my mind. So I decided one day that I was just going to tape up the covers for every issue that was coming out that I was working on, so I didn't lose track of what was happening. And then when the sketch was replaced with pencils, I replaced the art on the wall. I just printed them out and put it up there. So at any moment, if Josh asked about a cover, I could turn around and say, here's the stage. Here's where we are with this cover. Here's the finished artwork. Blah, blah, blah. It also helped marketing too. Susan would come over and she'd be like, okay, that's a great cover that I can send off to various news organizations. But basically that became a staple for the office, because it was just awesome to see the new art, but it was mainly just to keep my sanity. It really was. Because with that many covers, a ball was going to get dropped, and I didn't want that to happen. So
Joe Casey comes in with like a plot for the first 12 issues, and he writes a third arc, and then he realizes he's told his story and he should go. When do you start looking for a new writer? How do you find a new writer?
Joe was a little, I think he was a little frustrated in not really, he had worked on the X-Men. He had worked on a lot of stuff from Marvel before, but he had never worked on anything like a Hasbro product, where there are a lot of strictures and there are a lot of more confines. And I think he felt a little contained by that. And rightfully so. It's not easy to write a licensed product. It just isn't. Because you've got more people than just your editor and the comic company. You've got the corporation. You've got all those people. Right around the middle of the Phoenix Squad saga, I had been giving him, through that whole storyline, I had been giving him a lot of Easter eggs and a lot of things that he could do, directions he could go. Joe was really great about working with me to come up with the best story and how we were going to do it. But by the time that I was suggesting the next stage of where we went, I think it was either the Serpentor story or the Baroness story that followed. I was offering him some tips on how he could go with it and where we could go. And he was like, you know what? He said, Mike, you've got such a solid grasp on G.I. Joe. You should just write the book. He's like, you should just do it. And Josh wasn't too keen on that idea of having the editor also write the book. And I wasn't a name. I wouldn't bring in people, new readers or anything like that. but we knew Joe wanted to see Gout. He had told all he wanted to tell with G.I. Joe. He was a little tired of having the Hasbro overlords. And I just knew I worked really well with Mark Powers. He has great ideas. He is a humble, humble genius. And I just thought, this is somebody that I could build a world with without any friction. He and I worked very well together. We worked through disagreements quite amicably. And I knew that he was a better storyteller than anybody ever knew. So I was like, let's do it. Let's give it to him. But he couldn't start for a couple of months, which is why I wrote the two-parter. But I also knew that there were certain elements that I wanted to tie up from Joe Casey's run.
So remind us, where was Mark Powers when you wanted to bring him in?
Mark had moved back to New York. His wife, his in-laws, his mother-in-law was not doing well, needed some support. His wife had never really been outside of New York area, was really struggling with not being near family. And the time was right for him to be back. He had their first baby had been born. They needed family support. And so the time was right. And then, of course, I just kept in touch with Mark because he became such a great, great friend of mine, still is. So I just approached him about writing the book, and he was completely on board. He loved the idea. He loved the idea of being in the sandbox with me still, getting to play with stories, and he was up for it. But I knew that there were certain things that I wanted to do. I wanted to tie up, to finish the General Ray storyline. I wanted to have a palate cleanser after the big story with the Phoenix Squad in the Rock. And I wanted to bring back more of the personal element. And so that's why I decided to do little vignettes of each individual Joe character spaced out through finally wrapping up the Ray storyline. So for me, those two issues were mostly just me tying things up and then setting up the storyline for Mark to come in with that Baroness story. And I loved those two issues. I really did. Figuring out how we were going to resolve the Serpentor storyline, General Ray, going back and rereading all of the appearances of Serpentor, finding out how we could make sense of it all. And I'm a huge fan of that opening scene in issue 20 where it was just Xandar and Duke fighting without any sound effects, no dialogue, just them beating the tar out of each other. I loved that. I was a big fan of that. I just loved that.
And that Rey Serpentor storyline, how close to that with that wrap up of the story was it to the original intent of the introduction of the character, or was there a sort of grand vision of what this General Ray was going to be when he first appeared?
I'm not sure. I know that Brandon Jerwa and Josh Blaylock came up with the idea of Ray being Serpentor. As far as I know, I never saw anything written out of how they were going to resolve it. I never saw or heard anything about that they had the tell-all for how it was. They just knew he was Serpentor. As far as I know, they knew he was Serpentor. Eventually that would be revealed, but I don't know that they had a plan. So how it came out in the story was me. I was the one that wrote the resolution, came up with how it was going to be resolved. I wanted to bring in Crystal Ball just because he's ridiculous. And I just wanted a chance to redeem that ridiculous character a little bit. I wanted Duke to really have something to sink his teeth into and have a good storyline for him.
The artist Javier Cecilia, who draws half of your two issues, Mark, am I remembering correctly? We didn't find other credits for him in comics.
Yeah, we couldn't find any credits before or since. So we were just wondering if you could remember where he came from and where did he go to.
I believe he was one that sent. I would get submissions all the time from artists sending their art in, and I kept a big stack of artists that I liked that I knew I could get Hasbro to approve next to my desk, because you never know when you're going to need a new artist. You just don't, you know, people come and go all the time. Like I was, Tom Brevoort stole Caselli from me, you know. You know, he's a great artist. Of course, Marvel was going to notice him. I also was fortunate enough that I had finished grad school just a year or two before. And so I had great connections with my professors who would notify me if good artists were coming up. That's how I got Mike Baer, is that one of my professors said, hey, you should take a look at this artist. I pulled him in from SCAD. I don't specifically remember this artist, but I do think it was because he sent a really good submission, Javier Cecilia. Yeah. And I don't know where he went after that. I honestly don't. He was great though. I mean, I had to send him so much reference for that storyline, especially the two pages where it's retracing Serpentor's history. I mean, I was sending him just scan after scan of things that he needed for his, to draw those two couple of pages. And he was great about it.
Mike, how were sales? What were sales?
I intentionally tried to keep out of that, to be honest with you. I would read what people were saying because I needed to know that. I needed to know the general zeitgeist out there about G.I. Joe. So I would read what people would say about the stories and whatnot. But I intentionally tried to avoid getting numbers for sales because I didn't want that to affect me too much. I wanted Josh would let me know what I needed to know. I focused on, I want to tell a great story. I want to keep the longtime fans interested and keep, you know, because that's our bread and butter. I didn't want to lose them. But when Josh would come up and say, hey, I want to do a 25-cent issue, in my mind, it was like, okay, sales might be slipping a little bit. Okay, he needs me to do something to help bring it up. So I tried to stay away from that because I didn't want that to affect me too much. I just wanted to be consistent with telling good stories. And I think I did. I really do feel like the last half of America's Elite, I feel great about that. I feel solid with it. I really do. Fan response was positive. You know, you had the, just like any comics, you know, the comic readers are not happy unless what happens in the comic is what they would do. You get that. You get that all over. And I learned that lesson real quick. So I was able to disassociate a little bit more from that. But overall, I do think people found the last part, especially the last half of America's Elite, to be palatable, I hope. At least that's the feeling that I had.
Yeah. It certainly does feel like people hold World War III era in very high regard, and you know,
and that means a lot.
The pinnacle of so Tim and I are about to sort of start our deep dive read through into that era. So it's nice that we got that high point to be looking forward to.
It's awesome.
I've almost used up all of my questions, but one of them was just like, you know, as you were wrapping up Devil's Due era and G.I. Joe comics hasn't stopped since then. Have you tried to keep up with it all, or is it almost like, you know, you've had your bit and then everything past that is, you know, you're happy for that to live on, but maybe not necessarily collect or read yourself. So in a nutshell, G.I. Joe post Devil's Due, ...
Yeah. I hate alternate reality stories. I hate them. I really do. And I knew that IDW was going to do a complete reboot of G.I. Joe. And to me, that just felt like, okay, my G.I. Joe was gone. It was done. You know, we finished our story, ended it on a high note. But as far as I was concerned, the history that I had started with and the characters I had started with were over in, you know, from 1982 to now, because they were rebooting it. And I just felt like now is a good time for me to step away. I was, you know, there was a little part of me that was sad that we lost the license. Of course, I hated that. I wanted to keep telling Joe stories for the rest of my life. I loved it. But not really caring for a complete reboot of the characters, not really enjoying a lot of the art choices that IDW made with the artists that they hired, I just kind of decided that, okay, now's a good time for me to step away. And it's hard, you know, when you, I guess this is what parents feel like. You raise a kid, you do everything you can, and then it's hard to see them go out in the world. And, you know, it can be hard to follow them. And that's kind of how I felt about G.I. Joe. I raised this these characters for a couple of years, was very, very, very invested in what was happening. And it was hard to see somebody else take that and kind of basically ignore what we did and just go off in another direction. It was hard. And it was hard to see somebody else decide what Scarlet was going to do next. You know, that's tough. So I think I cocooned for a little while and I bagged out. And then I got reinterested in it when Hama's story, when he started writing A Real American Hero again. But then it felt a little bittersweet because they were completely ignoring everything they have in the Devil's Due. And now all of a sudden I was the ultimate reality. Oh, worst insult that ever happened to me in my entire life. I'm the very thing I hate the most. But then I heard some of the things that he was doing with the storyline. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to wait a while. Cause I'd wanted to pick him up and trade paperback sort of thing. And I just never did. I got busy with everything else in life. 3 full-time jobs, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just never picked it up. But I have gotten the bug to go back and to pick them all up again and read them from 155 on. So I've been collecting again. I have. The time just felt right. Enough time had passed. It feels like my stuff is still treated with fondness from fans, and it can be its own little existence off in the end, you know, but enough time has passed for me that I think I can go back and read them now. So I'm collecting them again and saving them until I can have one weekend where I just sit down and read them all from 155 and a half all the way up to 300 and just read them all.
If you need some issues, my store has many of them. Many stores have none because people were like, I'm not going to pick up that book. And I'm a G.I. Joe fan who owns a store. So we carried that book.
Well, I will be in touch with you. In fact, I'm hoping you can send me your website so I can, I will do that. I will get them through you. I was hoping to get all of the trade paperbacks of Hama's IDW run. So if that's something you can help me with, I'd be on board for that.
We have 3 of them. We have 3 or 4of them. But,
perfect.
But a bunch of them are out of print. But we have many, yeah. We have most of his issues.
Great. Well, then that's something I'll do is I'll come to you and I'll get them from you. And then whatever you don't have, I'll, you know, go to evil eBay. That'd be great. So, yeah, I'm ready to now see what he's done with it. I heard there were some silly things like a giant monster under the pit or something. So I'm not looking for... I'm not looking forward to
it's
that.
It's not a giant monster.
A giant eyeball.
An eyeball.
And, oh.
And it gets set up and then ignored because Hama thought he might need to or want to incorporate Transformers. So he laid some track for himself and then didn't need to. And then in other G.I. Joe comics, they met Transformers.
Okay. Which I think that's why it appeals to me now. As a fan, I tend to not enjoy stories as they're happening. I enjoy them when they're concluded. So I'm not I like to pick up the single issues, but then save them until I have a full story and then read them all at once. I don't collect trade paperbacks because I like the individual issues. They're fun. So I think now that IDW's version is complete and told, now I think I'll be able to enjoy it as a whole. And I'm excited to see where it goes next, that they're picking it up over at Image. And I'm thrilled by that. I think it's just a really neat respect that they are giving to this product that's just been going since 82. Good for them. Right on. So my interest is back a little bit, and I'm going to read the Hama stories, and then I think I will be end up picking up the Image stuff and getting myself back into it.
I kind of get the bulk reread aspect rather than necessarily the monthly read to a degree, because like when you're rereading en masse and you come to a bit of a bum issue, you know, one of the ones that's not quite so good, it's like, okay, that one wasn't so great, but I'll just move on to the next issue. If you're reading monthly and you're getting one issue a month, it's like, this is the issue. This is the one that I've got and it's not a good one. And I won't be able to see if the next one is any better or not until this time next month. So it seems a bit more, there's more weight to the current issue as you're kind of, you know, reading along.
And I think also my brain automatically takes stories and writes the official handbook of the Marvel Universe entry for them. So I really struggle with, I like it at the end because, you know, especially mysteries. I hate mysteries while I'm reading them, but I love it when it's over. because I have the answers. I can summarize it. I can resolve it. So that's why I struggle, me personally, that's why I struggle with it in piecemeal, because I want to know where it's going and I enjoy things more retroactively. If it's just something my brain's always been, but I'm a handbook writer and I'm an editor. That's what I do. That's where my brain goes. And I hate to admit it. I also struggle a lot of the times when it's something that I know really well, like the X-Men. If I'm reading an X-Men comic and they make a mistake, it's painful. It's painful to me. It really, I was a little nervous about Joe because they're hiring, what's his name that wrote Walking Dead?
Kirkman.
Thank you. Those guys write really, really great stories when they're their own characters, when they are characters that are.
I mean, you know, Kirkman's writing a G.I. Joe and Transformers adjacent series right now that is its own alternate reality. So, you know, I'm very excited about a new Duke comic that's not in the Hama verse, because it's written by a hot guy and it's drawn by, and colored by two real talents. And it's like, I don't really know if it'll be my Duke or Duke enough for me, but it's exciting and it'll look great. And if it's off, well, I still got my Duke over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also, in my collecting, I collect characters. I don't collect titles. I don't collect writers. I pick characters that I love and I pick up every single appearance they've ever had and every one that are coming out. So I've got a couple of characters that I have every single thing they've ever been in. And so that's how I do it. That's how I trace characters, is I collect characters. Kitty Pryde is my number one. I mean, that's my number one Marvel character. Kitty Pryde and Lockheed. Love them. They're just great characters. And it's tough when you get to a writer that just doesn't really understand them and doesn't have their voice. But I just be patient. The status quo always returns. It always comes back. You know, just wait it out and somebody will remember what her voice sounds like and they'll come back to it.
Mark, I think I'm out of questions.
Yeah. Looking back at my notes, I've basically covered everything. Was there anything on your magical clipboard
let me take a look. Let me see.
I wanted to ask, how did you get Michael Golden for America's Elite 36? Is there a story with the fact that the cover is pencils only?
It's what he wanted to do.
Okay.
I got Michael Golden by approaching him at a comic convention in Chicago, and I basically just gushed over him. I told him, you know, I'm an old school Joe fan. I've been a fan for years. I mean, those yearbook stories and covers that he drew. I mean, good Lord, are those incredible. And so I told him that I wanted him back for a special cover, and that I was also getting Herb Trimp to do a special cover for Joe 36, and that it would mean the world to me to wrap up this story with the, you know, the legacy of Joe Artis, the cream of the crop. I laid it on thick. I did. But he was great. He was, I mean, and that was, for me, that was a lot of fun to get a Joe cover from him. I wish that we could have done solid inks on it. I think it would have paid off a little bit better, but it at least matches the rest of the cover for that run for the World War III story.
I'm guessing a lot of readers didn't pick up on this, and I think I have a good eye for that. So if any listeners are like, wait, the cover's not inked? Then yes, I'm guessing, and Mike O'Sullivan is confirming.
Yes, it is not inked, and he wanted to do that, because he looked at our other covers and he saw that. I mean, most of our other covers are not inked too. I mean, if you look very carefully, you can see some loose pencil sketches, you know, pencil lines in the covers for this run.
So, Mark, was Blaylock saying last week to us that Golden had to rework the cover a little bit? Am I remembering this correctly?
I think there was feedback about weapons on the front cover, and there was a request from Hasbro that there was some changes.
Yep.
I'm sure Golden possibly loved that.
He had to go back to Golden, and Golden maybe wasn't too happy about being asked to make changes.
Well, luckily, I learned my lesson from the Adam Hughes, and I got sketches for everything. I mean, I was doing that on, I was doing that beforehand, but with a big name artist, especially Adam Hughes, I think I was, I trusted that Hasbro knew what they were going to get, and I was a little intimidated by it was Adam Hughes, and I didn't want to go to him and be like, "Can you do a sketch for me? Because I have to get it approved first." And I got burned bad. So at that point, it didn't matter who the artist was, whether it was a big name or not. I was getting the sketch. And so things could be reworked before it got to a stage where they had invested so much time and energy into art that they would be furious if they had to change it. I did it with Herb Trimp. I did it with Michael Golden. You name it. Because I did not want to have that Adam Hughes experience again.
Presumably a Michael Golden sketch is pretty good on its own. It's probably a little smaller and a little looser than finished pencil.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you squint, I bet some people out there would say, run that as the cover.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had kept it. I wish I had, I don't have the digital file for it anymore, but I wish I could see it because it would be great to, because yeah, I mean, the guy is just a phenomenal talent. You go back and look at anything he's done and it's just him, Arthur Adams. I tried very hard to get Arthur Adams to do a cover. Boy, did I work hard. He was who I had in mind at first for this.
Ah. And he was unavailable, uninterested?
Never heard back.
Huh.
I tried every avenue that I could. I was getting in touch with Marvel people that Mark Powers knew from his time at Marvel, and I could never get Arthur Adams to respond. Alex Ross got back to me and said he just doesn't have any interest in doing anything G.I. Joe. So that was a bummer. I was bummed about that. Here's a little interesting story about this cover.
This is G.I. Joe America's Elite, issue 25, with the massive amount of G.I. Joe characters on it.
I wanted to get every G.I. Joe character on a cover, and let me tell you, collecting the reference for this... Oh, was that hard? That was tough. And then that was a, you know, all of us were working, Sam Wells, me, we worked our butts off to make sure that everything was correct and the references and getting details correct. And boy, were we proud of this. Fast forward to 2012, maybe Marvel put out an issue of Deadpool, the wedding issue, where they had a ton of characters on that cover and then marketed it as they had the Guinness Book of World Records for the most amount of characters ever featured on a single comic book. And it was less than what we had on this. I was livid. I was so mad. I wanted to be like, no, we had more. And this was done years before your Deadpool cover ever got released. And I called Sam Wells and said, should we fight this? Should we go back to the Guinness Book of World Records and say, this one has more. We actually hold the record. And he told me that when the news came out about that the Deadpool cover, he talked to Josh Blalock about the same thing. And Josh Blalock said, I bet you anything, Mike O'Sullivan is losing his fucking mind about this. And he was right. So I got in touch with the Guinness Book of World Records people, and they told me how you could challenge something and you could actually get your record reinstated and blah, blah, blah. And then before I do it, somebody else came out with a cover that had more characters on it. So I was just like, you know what? It's just going to be a lot of one-upmanship. So I'm just going to walk away from this. So, but I know in my heart, I had the Guinness Book of World Records for a while. That was me. I did it.
You did. So we can probably check it on the website right now. The last time I looked, it was on the Guinness Book of World Records. I'll fill some time for a moment.
Arthur Adams has drawn the Baroness he's drawn the Baroness for some convention like sketches, and and he did do an IDW cover, and I think it was a cover for them and not like a commission that they found and then asked if they could turn into a cover. And this was when they used that Arthur Adams the Adam Hughes piece, and they had Michael Lark do some covers, so they brought in some people who I think one of the things that has happened is that in the 80s and 90s G.I. Joe was a job, and maybe it was kind of hot. I think if you were like a Mike Zeck, this was a fun thing to draw because that's his ballywick. And then it like swings the other way. And it's like, I think a lot of artists might sort of be the wrong generation, or, you know, the pay's not great, or they're not interested. And then another, all it takes is another 10 or 15 or 20 years. Like, I don't know Arthur Adams. I don't want to put words into his mouth, but
yeah,
he did do a He-Man Masters of the Universe cover last year for Dark Horse. And,
interesting.
You know, I don't know if anyone asked him at like Image and MV Creations or Wildstorm 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but, you know, maybe He-Man to sort of come back around enough that, and Arthur Adams is like, yeah, I'll do that. It's like, you know, Mike Mignola was doing some He-Man sketches during the pandemic. And
yeah,
and I, again, I don't know Mike Mignola, but sort of feel like if someone had asked him to do a He-Man cover 15 years ago, he might have declined.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know Alex Ross, he's phenomenal talent. Absolutely. I mean, the guy's incredible. But you can tell from anything that he works on that he has an era that he loves the most. And it's late 70s Marvel. So you can tell that edging into the 80s, not really his thing. And Joe was considered such an 80s project, a product that I knew it was a long shot. Because you even look at anything that he does for Marvel, and he always goes back to the visuals of the 70s. That's just what he loves, that era. So I knew it was a long shot. I hoped. I took a swing. I struck out, but I tried. I definitely tried. And at least he was polite enough to come back and tell me that he wasn't interested. That was phenomenal. And boy, am I glad to hear that Art Adams did some Joe stuff. That's great. That's awesome. I mean, the guy...
I was scrabbling around in the corner trying to find the print.
Oh, of his work? I mean, the guy could draw the Smurfs and it would be phenomenal. I mean, let's face it, he's a god among artists. So I'm glad that he got to do it. I just wish he had done it for me.
Here, I'll put this...
Okay, so I'm putting onto the screen the Guinness Book of World Records webpage for most comic book characters on a single issue cover, and it is G.I. Joe with 236 figures, excluding pets, from May 2007 by Chris Lai. So the Guinness Book of World Records website it currently lists that cover as the record holder.
I did not know. I wonder who went in and actually challenged it. I'm thrilled. That's awesome.
I mean, maybe someone at a publisher, maybe someone at Hasbro, maybe just a fan who this burned them up as much as it burned you up.
I wish I knew who did that. I'm thrilled. I had no idea that somebody went back and did that.
So I was able to let Chris Lai know this news as well when I spoke to him, and then in the same breath let him know that it's very soon to be lost again, because from 2022, G.I. Joe issue 300 with about 310 characters is going to follow.
If you have to claim this mantle with a G.I. Joe cover, isn't it nice and fitting to lose it to a G.I. Joe cover? Right? It's not like some like Canadian comic that you've never heard of, or you know, some like X-Men variant cover and they only printed five copies. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, it is. And that's a thrill. I mean, I saw it, and I think that's why I just kind of like, you know what, it's just going to get trumped by somebody else soon. So I just won't fight it. But I'm thrilled that we're at least in there. At some point we held the record, and that G.I. Joe 300 is going to come along and take it. That's awesome. That makes me really happy. Oh, you guys have made my day. That's really cool. I mean, I worked my tail off for this. Around that time, I mean, I was working so hard to acknowledge every character and to have those little things for everybody to get to see that we haven't forgotten things, and that we're entering things like Cobra Mortal and the Obscure and the Yeah. So that just makes me happy. That's a good plus for my day. So thank you for letting me know that. That's really cool.
Nice. I'm going to be
bragging about that one for a little while. That's fantastic.
It was all drawn together, right? It was not Photoshopped from many elements.
No, it was all drawn. One drawing. I do not know what he did with the original art. I wish I did.
It's on his office wall.
Is that right?
That's right. Mark,
out in Jakarta, I think.
Because he runs a studio.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That makes me happy.
Just as a contrast, the very fun, very exciting G.I. Joe 300 cover, all those characters were drawn separately.
And stitched.
That bothers me. That's too bad. I mean, hey, they got the job done and that's great. There's something about me being an old school, even in my own art, I hand draw everything.
The artist who did that had previously done a bunch of very busy, a bunch of characters all at once on the same artboard, G.I. Joe covers. So at least this was a decision the artist made to, like, in theory, make the job a little easier, but had done it the hard way before on a very similar project.
That's awesome.
And then was able to do the lovely thing of selling people their favorite character from that.
That's cool. Cover. Anything that gets an artist a little bit of extra money, I'm all for. I think that's phenomenal. Our Joe cover, though, the issue to 25, I mean, coming up with all of the references, and then we had people in the office that would take little breaks here and there, sit down at the computer and just plug in colors. Even if they were the wrong colors, just that it was colored, you know, that everything was colored. So then the artist, the colorist, I think it was West Ezioba. I can't remember. Could just then switch the color to the color it should be.
Because it's a half a step to change a color in Photoshop, and it is a full step to color something for the first time. Unless you're using that automated, like, tiling, like, color thing, which my friend showed me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why you see in the inside cover credits of America's Elite 25, cover by Chris Lee, Sam Wells, Mike O'Sullivan, Peter Sofranis, thanks to Yes Flat, Joshua Fritz, Timothy Straub, for artists. I mean, it was everybody and their brother worked on this one, but this was the Datadesk handbook. Those were some very, very happy years for me of just staying up late at night, just indulging in comics and fact checking and coming up with lists. And boy, I will remember this era with so much happiness and joy for the rest of my life. I will. This was just the biggest thrill of my life, is to get to work on these. It really was.
That sounds like a good stopping point.
Wonderful.
Well, I feel bad for your listeners having to listen to my rambling for hours on end. I feel bad for that.
They like the long version. What was it we were talking about? I think you were prompted by something on your list, maybe on your
Oh, I remember. This might be a little bit of interest to you guys and to anybody listening. I cannot remember all of the details, and I wish I could. I could not find I've got a book that has all of my G.I. Joe notes, and I couldn't find it in my storage stuff for before today. But somewhere I have what we plan to do with America's Elite after World War III.
Ooh.
Before we lost the license. And I was trying to pick it out of this quagmire that's in my head, that's my brain, and I couldn't. The only thing that I could remember is that we were going to end World War III with Cobra winning. They were going to win, and they were going to be, they had what they always wanted. They were going to have control of everything. And it was going to be a bunch of stories between then and issue 50, where it was G.I. Joe kind of underground, guerrilla tactics, becoming what they really should have been, or not what they should be, what they really were intended to be, which was not a lot of support, not a lot of technology, just people that were the best at what they do doing what they do, and high stakes, more, a little more gritty of, you know, clandestine type stuff, black stealth uniforms, you know, and we were going to keep making the plague a really big deal. We were going to keep making them, developing them, having them be key villains in helping maintain this world global order that Cobra had conquered. And then by issue 50, I think we were going to start breaking that down and having Joe get back to reigning Cobra in and whatnot. But I thought that might be a little interesting thing. And when we had lost the license is when we kind of took the brakes off a little bit and decided that, okay, let's have some things be finite. And that's when we decided that we would kill. I still think that scene is really kind of horribly awful, wonderful, that you don't ever see him. You just see people's reaction to his killing. I still think that was a pretty good choice on Mark's part, but yeah, that's where we were going to go with the series after it ended, or after World War III ended. Kind of bummed it didn't get to happen, but, neat little footnote.
Maybe that's a mini series. G.I. Joe Forever.
Yeah.
You know when Marvel does like X Factor Forever. You know?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Let's get the creators to come back and tell that one more story that they would have.
God, I would love to. Man, now I'm thinking I might do some fan fiction. I'd love it. Holy smokes. I should get in touch with an Image and say, hey, if you ever want a miniseries or continuing on the Devil's Due, I can get past my hatred of alternate realities to do that, I guess.
If it's a story I want to tell.
Exactly. Remember, fans don't like something unless it's what they would want to do themselves.
IDW did a Ninja Turtles anniversary special a couple of years ago. It was like square bound, and it was 48 pages, and it had it was like five brief stories, like six or seven or eight pages from each continuity, from the original the original Mirage continuity. They got the Archie guys back, who did like Mighty Mutanimals, which had its own little following at the end. They had the team that did Volume 3, the black and white Image Ninja Turtles continuity, which later got finished. And then they did a new story for like the then current new IDW continuity. And then there were some pinups. And I thought that was a really nice way to celebrate an anniversary and, you know, give a nod to everything. And
that's,
you know, for old school fans and new fans, and, you know,
that's fantastic. That's a really great idea.
And I think the cover is Eastman and Laird. I think that would be neat. I think it's the first time they'd collaborated in a while, like, you know, besides the like Toys That Made Us episode.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That's neat. I would love to see that. Luckily, Joe is, well, I guess there are what? Yeah, I guess there are three or four different realities for Joe now.
There have been comics based on the cartoon, very, you know, precisely on the cartoon. So with my magic wand, where I'm an editor of G.I. Joe, I would put together a like $9.99, you know, 100-page special where there's, you know, someone drawing and coloring in a Marvel 1982 style, and Hama writes it, and there'd be a like a Blaylock story and a, you know, like an animated story and an IDW continuity story, the non-Hama one, and then this new...
And a story by...
Mike O'Sullivan would...
Thank you!
Mike O'Sullivan. I'd ask Mike O'Sullivan to write and edit sort of like the imaginary coda, like issue 51. Can you do America's Elite 51 in 8 pages?
I'd love to go back and revisit Scarlet, to be honest with you. I mean, writing her Declassified story for me was just such a thrill to get to put all the pieces together and make it make sense. And I don't know if you noticed, but I pulled elements of that story into 19 and 20, the whole out there with her dad underneath the willow tree.
Yeah.
That's the type of stuff that I love doing. It's just those little bits that carry over everywhere. So the willow tree was a big thing in my thinking back then.
And you know, that early art from early work from Phil Noto as well.
Yeah, what a get.
Yeah, that was exciting. That was a total get for me too. I got in touch with Phil Noto through Rob Rohde. Rob Brody is a novelist that I absolutely loved. And then he wrote a comic book called Codename Knockout in the early 2000s. That was just
Vertigo.
Yeah, it was hilarious. I loved that book. And I picked it up because I read his novels. There was one called What They Did to Princess Paragon that was set in the comic book world. And it was a storyline where this novel is about John Byrne gets a hold of Wonder Woman and turns her lesbian, and how the comic book community just falls apart because all of a sudden this stand-in for Wonder Woman is now a lesbian. It's hilarious. It's just it's a phenomenal novel that's just hysterical. And so being a big fan of him, then finding out he lived two blocks away from the Devil's Due office, getting in touch with him, having him write a G.I. Joe story for me, and then becoming friends with him, having him get me in touch with Phil Noto, because Phil Noto did a lot of the art on Codename Knockout, and then getting him to do that Scarlet book was, oh my gosh, that was so exciting. That was so great to get him to do that.
That's great. And for the listeners, you can find out what we thought of Scarlet Declassified on our last Disavowed episode. Wow, we've been going a long time and don't want to monopolize your time too much further. So I think we can just about wrap up. I think that just leaves us to say thank you so much to Mike for being so generous with your time and sort of revealing some of the detail on these on the Devil's Due years. Great to have you on. Great stories.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you for inviting me. And this has been an absolute thrill. What a joy to get to go back here and talk to some fans and just indulge in that. So thank you guys very, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
So Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.
Love it. Thank you guys so much.